calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Tim Graham is with us. He's the director of media analysis at the Conservative Media Research Center, mrc.org, their website. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. You folks are quite concerned about all the coverage of the Da Vinci Code book and movie.
Well, basically, our point was that there has been a lot of promotion of the book and the movie, and it shows that the media has a bias toward promoting books and movies that suggest, well, Christianity could be a fraud. Now, if you go back to another movie that did get a fair amount of network coverage, which would have been The Passion of the Christ back in 2004, that was a more orthodox vision of, you know, Christ and his life. And
that was an S&M movie, Tim.
And the media coverage of that was much more hostile. Like, you know, there was a decent amount of it, but it was basically treated like a social problem.
The Passion of Christ did not talk at all about Jesus' teachings of compassion and love, and it was an S&M movie.
Don't you remember? There was the Sermon on the Mount was in there. Christians, Orthodox Christians, don't believe that the passion and death of Jesus is an S&M film. You're basically suggesting that Jesus was a masochist?
Speaking as an Orthodox Christian myself, I would say that I think that the importance, first of all, is the resurrection, not the death, number one. And secondly, if you want to get into that. And secondly, the teachings, the things that Jesus left behind. But the larger question here is, it seems to me that what's going on, the media is giving the Da Vinci Code all this publicity. They're giving an enormous amount of publicity to Christianity. Is that a bad thing?
Well, that's like saying that you could get a lot of press for Martin Luther King by doing a movie about how his many affairs. I mean,
it would ignite a whole brand new interest in Martin Luther King.
Well, I'm just simply saying, I'm sure that the King family wouldn't really appreciate that.
Probably not, but the bottom line is that at the end of the day, a lot of people would be talking about him who weren't talking about him before.
Any one of us could turn that around and say, you know, would Tom Hartman want to become famous by, you know, being accused of child molestation? I mean, you at some point you say, you know what, that kind of notoriety isn't really positive. I mean, you can try to turn it around and
but
say,
that's
well,
not what Jesus
great for Christianity, but it's not pro-Christianity. It's a movie and a book that claims that Christianity is an enormous fraud and that the Catholic Church has this murderous conspiracy against the people with the truth, which isn't the truth.
Well, you're conflating Christianity and the Catholic Church, first of all. It suggests that the Catholic Church has been perpetuating a fraud, not
yes,
Christianity.
Yes, well, I'm a Catholic Christian.
Okay.
Sorry
so,
about that.
So, yeah. Well, I guess it makes a certain amount of sense that you would conflate them. The Gospel of John, in John 13:25 and John 21:20, they talk about how John was the beloved disciple, the beloved disciple. And in John 13:25, he lays his hand on he lays himself on Jesus' inner tunic, his underwear. Was Jesus gay?
Well, that would be a first.
Bible suggesting that? I mean,
I don't think so. Usually the liberals are arguing that that Jesus never said anything about homosexuality, so it must be okay.
John 19:26.
Sort of seems to avoid all the letters of Paul, and it avoids the Old Testament.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting that Jesus never talked about sexuality. Don't condemn a woman who was caught in adultery. In other words, the only thing he said about sexuality was don't condemn people who are sexual.
Well, we're going to talk about conflating. I think that certainly we put marriage and sexuality together. I mean, he did tell the woman to go and sin no more. So obviously he was saying that she was in sexual sin. But also the whole notion of, you know, he certainly had a lot to say about marriage. And he certainly had a lot to say about how husbands and wives should give to each other. One of the ways we don't give to each other is by going out and cheating on each other. My simple point is that, yes, this is a movie which suggests, wouldn't it be cool if Jesus had a wife and a kid and You know, he was somehow a lot more human.
Well, in fact,
yeah.
I'll let you finish your point here, Tim.
Well, it's a secular media, and they want to sort of bring Jesus down to earth.
Yeah. Well, at that time, you know, 2,000 years ago, if Jesus was a rabbi or if he was a Jewish prophet, unmarried men were considered essentially weird. They were considered a curse. You know, you were in Judaism, the at that time, and I believe today as well, if you're a rabbi, if you're a great teacher, a prophet, or if insightful, knowledgeable, you're expected to have a lot of children, you know. And in Catholicism, interestingly, over the last 1,700 years anyway, if you are really smart, and for about 500-600 years of that time, if you wanted to have any education whatsoever, you had to swear off having children. And so, I mean, there are some who even suggest that the celibacy within the Catholic Church was part of a plot by people who were opposed to the Catholic Church to gradually, over generations, dumb down Catholics. And
wow.
Because the only way that you, if you wanted to learn how to read, the only way you could learn how to read was to go into seminary for most of the Dark Ages.
Now, I would simply say that the debunkers of the Da Vinci Code, whether it's Daryl Bach, whether it's Amy Wellborn, Hank Hanegraaff, you pick one, generally would state that it was not that unusual for a religious leader, or certainly not unusual for Jesus, to be a single man. I think that now on the Catholic thing, of course, is if the Catholic priesthood had decided that we were going to be at the Mass in persona Christi, if we're going to emulate Christ, then that's one way to emulate Christ. And I think that it's certainly true that, the priesthood in Catholicism, one of the things that's special about it is that they can pay attention to the flock and they don't have all the distractions of having wives and having children. I think that that's a beautiful thing as a Catholic. Certainly our media has always tried to treat the Catholic Church as sort of out of date and sick, and one of the things it picks on is the whole idea that, well, obviously if we didn't have the celibacy, then maybe we wouldn't have so many abusive priests. That's been one of the ways they've done it. Now, I believe in a secular media doing the work of making sure the Catholic Church stays on the straight and narrow. George Weigel put it very well when he suggested that the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe were doing the Lord's work on that. But it's very true that the news media is not exactly in the mainstream of Catholic thinking, and the Catholic Church is certainly not in the mainstream of the media's thinking.
So, bottom line here, you're of the opinion, and Media Research Center, MRC.org, we're talking with Tim Graham, media analyst at the Media Research Center, you're of the opinion that suggesting that Jesus might have been married is anti-Christian.
I'm saying that suggesting, as Teabing does in the book, that Jesus was immortal is suggesting that it seems quite obvious that Jesus was not God, that Jesus was a man. They claim in the book that Jesus' divinity was somehow invented in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. That's bizarre and not factual. But, you know, I guess it's one of the things that annoys me about this is that constant playing of the factual and the fictional and constantly dancing back and forth and saying, it's factual. Well, no, it's fiction. Why are you criticizing Dan Brown? He wrote a fiction book. It's in the fiction section with a fact page on the front page. When Brown went on the air in 2003 with several of the networks and basically said he wouldn't change a word of this if he was putting it forward as a nonfiction book. So,
but isn't faith fundamentally believing in things unseen, to paraphrase Paul? So, I mean, ultimately, if you want to use these definitions, it's all fiction, and we have to decide individually and personally which parts of which fiction we're going to believe or not believe, because it has to do with faith and belief. It doesn't have to do with evidence.
I think the word fiction suggests something untrue, and I think that certainly none of us wants to seek a God that does not exist or to seek an untrue or false God. I think we want to find the truth. I think that's what people are searching for. So in many people's minds, wouldn't you think that truth and fiction are polar opposites?
It's a good question. I would suggest that there is this middle ground between the two, which is called faith.
And, well, I was going to say, certainly.
I cannot prove the experiences that I've had that caused me to say that that I'm a Christian or that I'm that I can consider myself a religious person. I can't prove those. I can't point to them. I can't give them to anybody. They're inside me. Is that fiction? I don't know. Maybe I made it up. Maybe I hallucinated it. Maybe I imagined it. Is it fact? It seems like it to me, but there's no evidence for it.
Well, our whole point, Tom, is simply it's the news media, and they're supposed to be about the facts, and they've really mangled the facts here.
Yeah, okay. Tim Graham, the Media Research Center, MRC.org. You can read all about it over there. Tim, thanks for being with us and talking about this today. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth in broadcasting. Well, what is truth? We've heard that question before.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When your war is found to be based on lies and your approval ratings dive, don't you want somebody to hate? Yeah, you need somebody to hate. Come this November, it's probably too late. Bush better find somebody to hate.
All right, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. What was it, Chris Christopherson? If you need somebody to look down on, help yourself to me. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Oh, I said that already. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. I just have to say, if somebody was able to demonstrate to me that Jesus was gay or Jesus was married, it wouldn't change my thinking at all about Christianity, about calling myself a Christian, about my faith. It wouldn't. It's like, gee, he ate food. Okay. I'm going off here. Bob in Detroit. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
I had a question I would have loved to have asked your guest. If you remember, back in the early 70s, it was either Time Magazine or Life Magazine. On their cover, there was the headline said, God is dead or is God dead?
Right.
And shortly after that, in like 71 or 72, The Exorcist came out, the theaters. And when people were leaving the theaters, they were heading to stores to buy Bibles and knocking on rectory doors.
There was a huge fad of exorcisms that came out of that movie, actually, about 10 years.
Tom, the Catholic Church endorsed that movie, and they were getting all kinds of new parishioners into their congregations. Why wouldn't they do the same thing with this movie?
Well, because the Exorcist, first of all, was consistent with church doctrine, which is that there's evil, that there's evil spirits, that the evil spirits can take possession of humans. Jesus drove the demons out of this woman, and they went into this herd of pigs, and that kind of thing. Or no, it was a guy, actually, as I recall. And so it didn't contradict dogma, number one. And number two, the movie the Exorcist said, the solution to your problem, if you happen to be possessed, is to be found in the church. So, of course, the church would endorse it. The Da Vinci Code, on the other hand, says essentially the church is not the solution to your problem. The church actually is covering up their past, and they've reinvented themselves as something that they're not, basically as a Greek religion or as a Gnostic religion.
Sure, and I think like your point at the very beginning. I mean, this book is a work of fiction, and that is the bottom line, don't you think?
Well, no, I don't think that's the bottom line, actually. I mean, first of all, in the book, Dan Brown starts out the book by saying everything in this book is true, can be backed up. And what he's referring to is his primary source of research, the people who sued him for plagiarism, the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, who did an enormous amount of homework on that book. And it's actually a fascinating book. I read it probably 10 years ago when it first came out. And again, you read it and go, yeah, okay, this might have happened. So what? Does that have anything to do with how good I feel when I pray or when I go to whatever?
Sure. I mean, it's up to people to make up their own mind and come to their own conclusions.
Yeah.
I mean, who's for anybody to tell people how to do that?
Yeah. And
thanks, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate the call. Carlos in Driggs, Idaho. Hey, Carlos.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I'd like to say first off that, you know, I respect anybody's faith like your own, as long as it remains where it belongs, which is in your own heart and your own mind. Beyond that, when you bring your faith out into the public arena, I think you need to have a lot to answer to. And like your last guest, the problem is he makes quantum leaps in his logic when you start arguing whether Jesus was married or not, when still there's no conclusive evidence he ever existed. So I'd like to plead ignorance here, and I'd like to ask yourself or your audience to please answer a couple of questions. Is there any historical document that mentions Jesus aside from the Bible, like some Roman document that says, oh, that troublemaker over there in Jerusalem or whatever? Because I could go back 5,000 years in Chinese history and find evidence, clear evidence of the existence of a much lesser important person, or the same thing.
Certainly
in
a Buddha. You know, Carlos, I don't pretend to be a scholar of Christianity, but I know that there is and has been a long-running debate, particularly outside of Christianity, although also within Christianity, about, you know, who exactly was Jesus and where did he exist and what is the historical record. And you're right, it's a very flimsy historical record.
Yeah, exactly. So then, you know,
that's why I said to Tim, I said, you know, he said, isn't it fact or fiction? And I said, no, there's this thing in the middle. It's called faith.
Faith, exactly. And that's a great point you made, and I'm glad you made it, and I hope the rest of your audience listens, because, you know, when you start bringing it out to the public arena, you start trying to, you know, affect the lives and functioning of other people, because like myself, no disrespect to you, but I consider myself not being too weak to need faith or anything. You know, I take the world and the universe as it is. You know, I don't need to believe in God.
Yeah, and I salute you for that. I'll be the first to say that I get a lot of strength from my faith. I mean, it's something that's a comfort to me. And if that makes me weak, so be it. You know,
not at all. I believe drawing personal strength from anything is commendable, as long as you don't try to impose it on another individual.
Yeah, no, I'm not an evangelist or an evangelical. So, Carlos,
right.
We got to run.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's telephone number 866-440-8466. Our chat room, live chat room, tomhartman.com. There's a lot of other news here I want to get into as well. Some economic news. We can wrap up this conversation after the break. And on we go. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman program. In the third hour of our program, by the way, just a heads up, Dave Berman is going to be with us. He's the co-founder of the Vote Confidence Committee of Humboldt County, California, on the topic of the theft of the American vote. This is happening at the same time that Robert Kennedy Jr. has, from the news reports I'm reading, authored a piece which will be apparently appearing today on the website of Rolling Stone magazine and tomorrow in the newspaper itself, assuming that everything is accurate, suggesting that the 2004 election was in fact stolen by Republican operatives in the state of Ohio, and already the right-wingers have started attacking him. Here's one from Anonymous, one of the right-wing ditto heads. He says, oh, whoop-de-doo, a magazine that reviews crappy music and still thinks it's cool to get stoned and have sex with anything that moves, and the article's written by a guy named Hick Kennedy. That's it, folks. Rolling Stone is finished. Yeah, as Mark Crispin Miller notes, the Bushevics have an immense new problem on their hands, so let's all hang together. All hail RFK Jr. and speak up on his behalf. So we'll be getting into that in the third hour of the program. 1-866-440-8466. Wade in San Jose, California. Hey, Wade.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
I just wanted to let you know, I actually have a degree in biblical studies, and there are some works done by a guy named Josephus.
Josephus, the Roman historian.
Right. It was about 50 to 60 years after Christ, and you can actually go out and find the book. It's called The Works of Josephus, and he actually cites categorically not only the existence of Jesus, but solidifies a lot of the stories that were told by the disciples in the epistles.
Right. He talks about the the talk about. He, Josephus,
right,
didn't actually meet Jesus. He's talking about the fact that there was this event going on. There was this minor sensation, this guy who was drawing attention and causing problems, causing disturbances and problems for the Roman whatever, you know, at the time.
Right, but I want to put it out there to help out that caller that there are pieces of information that are out there, none that,
sure,
you know, directly solidify it, but some,
yeah,
that definitely back it up.
It's hard to believe, though, that, you know, a movement would form and people would be willing to die. I mean, you go back and you look at the disciples, you know, Stephen, I believe, had his skin stripped from his body. Others were boiled alive. Some, you know, was it Peter crucified upside down? I mean,
upside down,
some of the horrible things that they would go through that for somebody who didn't exist.
Right.
You know, I just find that hard to believe. Anyhow.
Can I have one more comment?
Sure.
Just that I'm not really surprised by a lot of the right-wing fundamentalists, you know, Christians that are upset with the Da Vinci Code, only because one of the main tenets of fundamentalist Christianity, whether it be Catholicism or otherwise, is that you don't question your belief.
Yeah.
You just accept what they tell you at face value. So it's not really surprising to me.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where I depart with from many sects in Christianity. And one of the reasons why for a lot of years I was reluctant to call myself a Christian, because there are a lot of churches that wouldn't have me, right? Because they would say, hey, wait a minute, you know, because I'm not, you know, absolutely right down the road on all the doctrine in any particular sect. Even I was raised in the United Methodist Church, and yet I think that it's time for those of us of faith to lay claim to that title again, to that name. That's why I'm using it. Anyhow, Wade, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
Have a good day.
KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ. Or Camas.
Hey, about celibacy, first of all, of Jesus. 2,000 years ago, Jewish law required that a father, in this case Joseph, find his son a wife. Secondly, they called him rabbi. This was not just a name. This was a title that you earned, and part of the requirements was that you had a wife.
Right.
Thirdly, Mary Magdalene pouring oil on his feet, wiping his feet with her hair. This was an act of seduction that would have been very inappropriate for any woman to do to a man who was not her husband.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, and
as I said, it doesn't. You know, it's fine with me if Jesus was married. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It made me. I don't know why it's an issue, and maybe that's why they don't mention it in the New Testament issue. Now,
yeah. KJ, I'm sorry, you're breaking up so badly. I can't hear you, and it's got to be making our listeners crazy. But good points. Peter in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Peter.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Good. What's up?
My problem with the idea of Jesus being married is that again sets up another royal dynasty, and would then, who is his lineage, and should we be worshiping them as kings?
That's been going on for a long time. In the south of France, there's this whole group of people who think,
yeah,
that they're related to Jesus, and it's been going on for 1,000 years, and they're
right,
dead serious about it. I mean, you know, in the movie, I was surprised that they didn't play that up more in the movie, because that really is, you know, the St. Clair's, and there's several families there in the south part of France who, I mean, and there
right,
have been folks who have
been... family, and, yeah, Josh, what's his name, that is on the... History Channel did a study about that, and he actually tested the DNA from the Merovingian dynasty to see if there was any bloodline that would link them to Middle Eastern bloodlines, and there wasn't. So, I mean, that right there is pretty interesting evidence. But
well,
the
maybe
main point
he, maybe
is
he lived on and adopted.
Pardon?
Maybe he adopted.
Maybe. But see, the main point is that we are Jesus' children. That's,
yeah,
that's the idea of Christian faith. And the other possibility is not only could the church actually be wrong, but Christianity be right, but I believe that that's in fact the case. That explains why you are alienated. Jesus never intended for it to become an establishment religion set up by the ruling powerful class. That's why the Jews, you know, because obviously not all Jews rejected Christ, but the establishment.
In fact, all of the Christians then were called Jews.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah,
all of the people who embraced Jesus were Jews.
It was the establishment.
It was the Romans
that rejected
who
him.
Yeah, and here's this interesting thing. There's this one teaching of Jesus where he talks about, or actually it's three teachings, but it's in one place, where he says, you know, if a person slaps you with the right, you know, on your right cheek, let them slap you on the left cheek. Yeah. Or if they slap you on the left cheek, present your right cheek as well.
Right.
There's another where, you know, if a man compels you to walk a mile, walk a second mile with him. And a third, if he takes your tunic, give him your cloak as well. Or if he takes your cloak, give him your tunic as well. In fact, the Romans had anti-exploitation laws. They knew these were for all of their occupied territories. We should, by the way, have something like this in Iraq. I mean, they basically, because, you know, the Iraqis are looking at these contractors making $150,000 a year when they can't earn $5 a day, and they're furious. The anti-exploitation laws were to prevent insurgencies. And the anti-exploitation laws applied to Roman citizens.
Yep.
Roman citizens, this was in the era before toilet paper. And in fact, much of the Middle East still doesn't use toilet paper. I've been there. You have public toilets, you have a little dripping water next to the toilet, and you wash your left hand off with that, right? And you just use your left hand. The left hand is unclean.
Uh-huh.
And so if somebody slaps you, and what was allowed in the Roman times was that you could, in an occupied territory, you could insult somebody, but you could not. But if you challenged them to a fight, you had to be willing to actually fight with them.
Right.
In other words, you couldn't use your Roman citizenship to.
Well, I think a lot of.
Well, let me just finish this, Peter. So you could, if you slap somebody with your left hand, which cheek are you going to hit them on the face?
Probably the right.
It would be the right cheek. And so then if you hit them with your right hand, you've now challenged them to a duel. Jesus said, if somebody slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other cheek to them as well. Right? In other words, he's like, okay, so if somebody insults you, challenge them to a fight, essentially. They walk a mile. The Roman law at that time, and I get all this, by the way, from Elaine Pagels, who's a brilliant scholar of that era. The Roman law allowed you to walk up to somebody in an occupied territory and say, carry this for 1 mile, but no more than 1 mile. If you, as a Roman citizen, forced a person in occupied territory to carry something more than a mile, you could literally lose your citizenship. Which would be like a death sentence.
Right.
So Jesus says, if somebody forces you to carry something for a mile, carry it that second mile.
Right.
That entire second mile, that person's life is in jeopardy who forced you to carry it the first mile. These are acts of rebellion. Again, cloak and tunic. You had basically a, it would be like today, a shirt and a coat, right? Only it was, or, you know, like a toga and a coat.
Uh-huh.
And the tunic was, or the cloak was the outer garment. The tunic was, you know, worn during the hot day when you worked. And people would hang on to the cloak of their slaves to force them to come back and eat in, because this was also what they slept in. This was like your sleeping bag. And Jesus, and you were not allowed to take the tunic from slaves. They would be standing naked in front of you. That was a violation of the anti-exploitation laws. So Jesus says, if somebody takes your cloak, in other words, if they try to make you a slave, because in the occupied territories, you could just walk up to somebody and say, okay, you're going to be my slave now. Give me your cloak. If somebody tries to take your cloak, give me your tunic as well. In other words, now you're naked in front of them. Now they have broken the law, and they are risking losing their Roman citizenship.
That's an excellent observation in the turnaround, but obviously, you know, what you're saying is that Jesus was somewhat anti-establishment.
He was a rebel.
That's absolutely true. If Jesus came today to most of the denominational system in the Roman Catholic Church, they would do the same thing to him.
He would be busting up the tables the same as he did back then.
Exactly. And you know what's interesting is that all the miracles and the things that he preached, it wasn't till he went into the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers. That's what got him angry. He started messing with their monetary system and their system of exploiting the poor. But, I mean, ultimately, Jesus' message was that of love, and that we have the opportunity to be transformed by seeing the incredible love of God that is transforming. That is the message, and then we are born again. It's not a doctrine.
Yeah.
You're not saved by a doctrine. You're saved by a reality of an experience. And those people,
I'm right there with you, Peter. I just want to interrupt you because we just have a couple seconds left. Well, in fact, here it goes. There goes the music. But I wanted to tell you, first of all, thanks for the call and thanks for your kind comments. The Purpose-Driven Life Takers by Jonathan Hudson. You got to check this out. There's a new video game out where you are a born-again Christian, and it's the end of days, and you have to kill as many non-Christians as possible. And this seems to be linked to a guy who's linked to Rick Warren, the pastor, the Purpose-Driven Life. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We must succeed. When freedom gets off track,
when freedom gets off track,
it's hard to get it back,
it's hard to get it back.
So till the next attack, you know we're on your back, and we'll be watching you.
That's just what we need. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS for all things Macintosh and iPod, and the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine, 1-888-ECO-WINE for fine organic French wines. The game is called Left Behind, Eternal Forces. It's based on scenes from the first four novels in the series. The game, developed by a publicly traded company called Left Behind Games, according to SEC records. They obtained a license from Tyndale House, the Christian publisher of Left Behind. Tyndale House also publishes Bringing Up Boys and the Complete Marriage and Family Home Reference Guide by James Dobson, who says, avoid video games, avoid violent video games. He hasn't stated his views on this one, however. This Left Behind Games CEO, Troy Linden, this is from Newsweek, whose company went public in February, says the game's Christian themes will grab the audience that didn't mind gore in The Passion of the Christ. We've thought through how the Christian right and the liberal left will slam us, says Linden, but megachurches are very likely to embrace this game. And this game. Imagine you are a foot soldier in a paramilitary group whose purpose is to remake America as a Christian theocracy and establish its worldly vision of the dominion of Christ over all aspects of life. You are issued high-tech military weaponry and instructed to engage the infidels in the streets of New York City. You're on a mission, both a religious mission and a military mission, to convert or kill Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, gays, and anyone who advocates the separation of church and state, especially moderate mainstream Christians. Your mission is to conduct physical and spiritual warfare. All who resist must be taken out with extreme prejudice. You've never felt so powerful, so driven by a purpose. You're 13 years old. You're playing a real-time strategy video game whose creators are linked to the empire of megachurch pastor Rick Warren, best-selling author of The Purpose-Driven Life. The game's slated for release by October 2006 in time for the Christmas shopping rush. No, I am not kidding you. It's amazing. Amazing. Jerry in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I'm surprised I got on this time, but a lot of the things I wanted to talk about, the way your last two callers brought up, mm-hmm. Josephus and Eusebius, who were both historians. Josephus was actually Jewish, and then he switched sides
mm-hmm.
during the Great War. But the thing that scares me the most, Tom, is what you started to talk about, the game. And the rapturists that believe that the Christ is coming and it's important to help bring that about, which is where George Bush and the rest of them, their theology is based on that.
Yeah, I was in Jerusalem back, this must have been about 15 years ago, it was in the 80s, in the late 80s, when a guy who, as I'm recalling, his name was Ron Goodman, I may be wrong though on his name, went into the Temple Mount area, you know, above the Wailing Wall there, where it's believed that the Second Temple was, you know, is buried like, you know, hundreds of feet underground, and started going off with a machine gun, and he had in his backpack a tent, because one of the prophecies is that the Second Temple has to be rebuilt, you know, the Third Temple, and it has to be in the same location. And some fundamentalist Christians have interpreted that to mean that if as little as a tent is put up over the spot where the Ark of the Covenant is, which is believed to be right, you know, next door to where the Dome of the Rock is, that will bring about the return of Jesus.
Right.
And I mean, there's some people who are real serious about this stuff. Tim McVeigh was one of them, by the way.
Yeah. And what's scary is the why do we need to worry about the environment? Why do we need to worry about the mounting debt? Why do we need to worry about other people when Jesus is going to come back and make this heaven on earth, and those of us that believe that way are going to be in heaven?
Right, which is the point that James Watt made, by the way, when he was Secretary of the Interior, and he was asked, you know, why are you selling off all the Western lands for pennies on the dollar? And he said, because Jesus is going to come back and make it all new. And you know, it might be fine religious policy, but it's lousy domestic policy. It's lousy politics.
It's just, not even good religious policy.
Well, I would agree with you, but you know, I think people are allowed to believe whatever they want to believe. And,
right.
And I mean, the thing that spooks me is that you have Bush believing this on our side, and then you've got Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, who is a believer in a very similar sect in Shia Islam, and it's a minority sect in Shia Islam that believes that the hidden mufti, the essentially the number two guy to the prophet, who will become the new prophet, right? In other words, the is going to return, and that if you read the Quran right, that return will only come when there's fire in the sky above Baghdad. And so he's, like, trying to bring about the end times. And if he dies in the process, then he becomes a martyr and he has 72 virgins. He's trying to bring about a Holocaust. Bush is trying to bring about a Holocaust. And, the rest of us are saying, hey, you know, we'd like to leave this world to our children and grandchildren and you know, let people have whatever faith they want or whatever beliefs they want. But let's not interject this into politics. It's absolutely spooky. Jerry,
yeah,
I've got to move along.
It scares me to death.
Yeah, it concerns me a lot. Thank you for the call.
The one thing I learned, the most important thing when I went to seminary, is history is written by those who win.
Yeah, to paraphrase, was it Hitler or was it Goebbels who said that?
I think it was Goebbels who also said.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for letting me talk to you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. It's an amazing topic, particularly when you get into things like this video game. New York City, I'm looking at a screenshot of it. It's New York City in flames as the Christian finalists are running around, you know, nuking the planet. Next, the importance of having an economy that puts people first with our guest Jared Bernstein. Jared is the author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. We'll be talking with him right after the break. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, where we run rings around the right wing every single day.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Jared Bernstein's with us. He's the author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. The website, bkcurrents.com, the publisher. Jared, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You write about yo-yo economics?
Right.
What is this?
Yo-yo is an acronym for you're on your own, and I describe that as the dominant, really social and economic policy thrust of the last couple of decades, really coming to a head, I think, with the conservatives in power now. The idea is that embedded in the DNA of really every conservative policy down the pike is this notion that we're going to shift the risks inherent in lives in an economy like ours from government and from corporations onto individuals. It's a you're-on-your-own approach to economics. It's and it's bad news socially, and it's inefficient economics.
And so how do we, you know, what do we do? How do we point this out to people? I don't think that most, I mean, there was the headlines in the newspapers over the last 2 days or so, you know, government to New Orleans or government to people in the West, on the Pacific, or the Atlantic coast, rather, you know, drop dead or you're on your own or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, I don't think most Americans get it. When these guys talk about things like tax cuts, what they're really talking about is also reductions in, quote, benefits, which really isn't benefits, it's protections.
Well, you know, I think people are starting to get it, but in a way, it hasn't been framed as such to make it really accessible. If you look at the economic polls in recent months, what I'm seeing is not simply, you know, we're unhappy because gas prices are high. It's really we're unhappy because there is a basic systemic core incompetency going on in government at every level. And you see it among red staters and blue staters. It's kind of like LaGuardia said years ago, there's no Democrat or Republican way to clean the street, there's just a right way. Well, in fact, I think people intuitively recognize that when it comes to globalization, when it comes to health care, when it comes to these massive inequalities with profits off the charts but real earnings falling or being squeezed, something's got to give. And the notion that somehow you by yourself with a tax cut in the private market can best fend for yourself and meet these challenges, it just doesn't make sense to folks. The problem is, and I wrote about this on an op-ed on TomPaine.com recently, is that no one's really articulating an alternative vision and putting things under a frame which I'm calling this yo-yo economics. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the best frame in the world, but at least it's one, and I hope people can use that usefully to see this more clearly.
Well, with all due respect to Mayor LaGuardia, I would suggest that who I believe that's who you quoted, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the
a Republican.
very much so. That there are in fact Republican and Democratic ways to clean the streets. That the Democrats would say that the streets should be cleaned by public employees who are members of a union, who are paid a decent wage and who have a pension.
Right.
And the Republicans would say the streets should be cleaned by a private corporation, which is being paid with tax dollars taken from you and me,
right.
Which can hire people with no pensions, no benefits, at the lowest possible wage,
mm-hmm.
and have them work under the most difficult conditions, and yet be able to be sure to give its CEO and its directors and its stockholders millions and millions of dollars.
Well, yeah, and so when I say there's a right and a wrong way to do it, obviously the latter is the wrong way. And in fact, you know, this is again where you
But a lot of people are buying into this, Jerry.
Well, but this is where you get to these core incompetencies that are so unsettling. I mean, I think folks have quite clearly recognized that our response to the government's response at all levels to Hurricane Katrina was incompetent at best and lethal at worst. And if you go back and do a touch of research on this, you will find that when Bush was elected, his first appointee to FEMA was his campaign director, who said, you know what, we really ought to let the churches handle this. In other words, you're on your own. Now, here are the outcomes. What's needed, I probably, you know, maybe I'm a little more optimistic than you are. I believe that the problems are so visible to people that if presented with a set of solutions, an agenda, which in my book I call the WIT agenda, we're in this together, they would respond. I think, and I don't mean by they, I mean a majority of the electorate.
Well, that's the fundamental cleavage between the conservative worldview and the traditional American worldview. Is the conservative worldview has always said, literally, you're on your own. It's all about the rugged individualist, you know, the
right.
Ayn Rand notion from Atlas mm-hmm. Shrugged, you know, who is John Galt, all that kind of stuff. And the traditional American view has been, we're all in this together. That's why we created this country. That's why we put together the Constitution. It's why, you know, we have governments. We are in this together.
My book is called Common Sense for a Fair Economy. The common sense comes from Thomas Paine, who I cite throughout the book, who is one of our, you know, one of the founding fathers, one of the original revolutionaries here. And by the way, I mean, there is a place for rugged individualism within all of this, but that kind of individualism can't exist in a context where you're getting crushed by forces that are far beyond your control. If your budget is completely decimated by an inefficient and tilted healthcare system, if the globalization is leading to insecurities, well, then how are folks supposed to recognize their individual potential?
Well, Jared Bernstein, you, author of Common Sense for a Fair Economy, or altogether now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy, you point out, and I think accurately, that most people view what happened with Katrina, most people look at our healthcare system, for that matter, and say this
mm-hmm.
thing is broken. You know, more than 75, depending on which study you look at, which poll, between 75 and 85% of Americans not only are willing to pay more taxes to have a national healthcare system,
mm-hmm.
but believe that it's imperative. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not just, you know, let's roll back the Bush tax cuts. I mean, it's even more than that. So if the majority of Americans actually believe that and or agree with your perspective and my perspective, why is it that the majority of politicians are not implementing those policies?
Well, I think I try to cover this in chapter 2 of my book, which is called The Economist Behind the Curtain. And this is the idea that this notion of yo-yo economics has been pushed so far that people have been convinced that somehow with the enough tax cuts and the right incentives in the tax system, they will be able to go out into the market and fend for themselves get the best result. As you suggested, not only is it visibly broken on a daily basis, but it's a level of propaganda that was never true. The idea the WIT economic agenda, which is let's craft economic policy to push back against these forces that are really harmful to our living standards, that's off the table, because the minute you raise one of these ideas, some yo-yo economist is going to say, you're going to kill the golden goose, that's too much regulation in our economy, you know the story, yada, yada. What I try to go through in the book is why that's a totally bogus argument that cuts off at the knees all of the channels we need to take, and as you correctly pointed out, channels that broad majorities of our society recognize we need to take. Now, who are these yo-yo economists serving? Well, of course, they're serving that very top, 5% of the wealth scale that's benefiting terrifically from this argument. So it's an ideology that has turned into a political philosophy embraced by both sides of the aisle, and the costs are steep.
I would suggest, though, that even the top 5% isn't served by this. If we end up living in a society where tuberculosis is rampant, poor children are standing out in front of your house with their hands out for food when you walk out of the house in the morning, where you live in fear of crime, it's just...
Well, that, Tom, is, in my opinion, why it has always taken huge disasters to essentially wake up the WIT agenda and to kill this yo-yo economics.
Well, the last time this happened was the Great Depression.
Exactly.
Are you suggesting that we need another Great Depression to bring this about?
And no, I mean, I certainly hope we don't, and I don't believe we do. I think what we need is actually quality leadership who starts making these cases to a public who is actually ready to hear it. I mean, you read not only Barack Obama, obviously a liberal senator, but also even some centrist Democrats are beginning to talk in these ways. The problem for the Democrats, though, is that half of them, or probably three quarters, are basically saying, well, look, if your opponent's beating himself up, you just sit on the side and watch. That's not going to work. I mean, I believe there is an audience for this message right now, and I certainly hope it doesn't take a depression to wake folks up.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out that these Democrats that you and the mainstream media refer to as centrists are actually right-wing extremists within the Democratic Party, because if 80% of the American people, for example, want national health care, that's not a liberal position.
It's not
a centrist position.
And I agree.
Joe Lieberman's opposition to national health care, if 65% of the American people think we should be out of Iraq within a month, that's not an extremist position.
No,
that's
you're absolutely right.
Position.
And by the way, the health care thing, in my view, at this point, shouldn't be even framed as a Democrat or a Republican path, in the sense that it's an albatross around American businesses' neck as well. I mean, this isn't simply some radical lefty idea in order to improve our social, the provision of this social good. It's also a critically important competitive investment. I mean, we simply can't compete in global markets with as inefficient a health system as we have, something, by the way, that every other advanced economy has recognized.
Indeed. Jared Bernstein, the author of the book, is All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. EPI.org, the website, Jared?
Yeah, that's our website, but the book is available at bkcurrents.com and also on Amazon.
Great.
Jared and Bernstein. Powell's books, too, which is a union shop, by the way.
Indeed, right here in our town in Portland, Oregon. Jared Bernstein, All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. Jared, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, an update from the White House with the Talk Radio News Service. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Staring at the blank page before you. Open up the dirty window. Let the sun illuminate the white light. You cannot find reaching for something in the distance. So close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions. Feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you. Only you can let.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program exposing the con in conservative. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, the senior White House correspondent. That is where you are today, right?
I am in the basement of the White House.
Ah, our senior basement correspondent.
Yes, I'm a senior basement correspondent.
Okay, so what's happening in the basement of the White House today, Victoria Jones?
Well, we just had the briefing with White House Press Secretary Tony Snow. I don't know why I'm telling you that, because I can't tell you that I know a lot more after it than I did before, but just thought I'd mention it. One thing we did get, though, was a timeline on Haditha, which was helpful in as much as, you know, it's good to have some idea of when certain things went down. We do know now that it was on the 2nd, on the 10th of February that Time magazine contacted the military in Baghdad. Now, we had been told yesterday, and I do think this was an error, that Time magazine contacted the White House, and it was subsequent to that that the president was briefed by National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. Well, it now seems as though Time never did contact the White House.
Isn't that what Tony Snow said a couple of days ago?
Yeah, that's what he said yesterday, and he apologized. I called him on that today, and he says that he must have been incorrect, that they had contacted Baghdad and not contacted the White House. And what seems to have happened is you've got this timeline of that, then you've got on the 14th, you've got a general appointing an investigation, then you've got other investigations being appointed. Then on the 10th of March, you've got the Secretary of Defense and Peter Pace, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, learning about this. And on the 11th of March, you've got the President being briefed by Hadley. So the Secretary of Defense knew before the President did. Now, whether anybody else in the White House knew before the President did is not clear. We've also been told that the President has received regular briefings with the Secretary of Defense and sometimes with Peter Pace subsequent to that, and has been kept up to date. So we've been told that's what's going on with that. So, you know, we're being led to believe that everything's under control.
Well, with a situation like this, if this is what it appears to be, it's just a disaster. There's no way to spin it. There's no upside to it. They need to come clean as quickly as they can and put it behind them. And instituting a morals training course in the military is not going to solve the problem that Jack Murtha so correctly points out, which is that you've got soldiers who are doing their second, third, fourth tour of duty in a war zone, and you're surprised that they snap?
And these, in fact, were soldiers, most of whom, I believe, were on their second tour, and some of whom were on their third tour.
Yeah, which is not to say, you know, gee, it's okay what they did, but you know, when soldiers go nuts in time of war, if the conditions under which they are fighting, and particularly if they're fighting, you know, if they're not even clear what they're fighting for, and, you know, they're fighting for a lie, and they're doing it, and they're watching their friends die.
Incrementally, you know, going up a street. It's not even as though they're going into battle.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they are in, and I think this is Jack Murtha's, the point that he has made so eloquently on a number of occasions. Yeah, and it's not to defend the soldiers, and it's an indictment of the administration, frankly. And I think that's why so many people are attacking Murtha, is that George W. Bush created this situation. Bush, Rice, Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, arguably, created this situation, and they did it. And this is a predictable consequence of this kind of a situation. You get soldiers in guerrilla warfare where they're living in constant terror 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, year after year, and they are some of them are just going to blow their fuses. And again, that's not to say that there is anything defensible about it. It is that. And certainly they need to be, you know, found and punished for what they did. I mean, if for no other reason than to tell every other soldier, don't ever even think about doing something like
this.
But the bottom line is they shouldn't have been in this situation in the first place.
No, it has to be a deterrent. There has to be punishment. You can't go around killing two-year-olds. It's not acceptable behavior in any aspect of any society existing currently on Earth.
No, and those of us who are civilians and who are not in the war, and I have not fought in war, but I have been in wars. I've been in war zones. And I got to tell you, you've got people who were trained to kill. They were told, you know, those normal rules that you were taught, do not kill, those no longer apply. We're training you to kill. Now go out there and kill, but only kill selectively. And that's walking down a razor blade. That's walking a very, very narrow line that I think a lot of people just don't understand and don't get. And again, not to not to in any way defend these guys, if what is said was true, it's horrific. But we just have to understand when you start a war that this is the kind of stuff that happens and or that can happen. And Bush, I just don't think, had any idea when he started this war.
I don't think he had a clue. Well, I don't think he thought it was going to be a war like this. I think he thought it was going to be a liberation.
Yeah, it was going to be a two-week war, and he had. It's not like he didn't have, you know, people in the military telling him that he was wrong. It's he just didn't want to hear it. I just want to put all of this on the Bush administration, or most of it. It's because that's where I think the responsibility lies, and I'm not seeing the media do that. The only person out there doing that I'm seeing is Jack Murtha. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I once was young and starry eyed. Now I have these bittersweet memories. Songs were long and gas was cheap. No cell phones and water was free. Daddy paid and I never had to worry. Not no more. Not no more.
Time now for our Iraq update.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
This from Reuters, the following are security and other developments in Iraq. On Thursday, as of 0800 GMT, the new Shiite-led government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has vowed to rein in insurgent and sectarian violence that has killed thousands of people since U.S. forces invaded Iraq in 2003. And meanwhile, in Baghdad, two laborers were killed and 21 wounded when a roadside bomb went off at the El Tayaran Square in central Baghdad, a Ministry of the Interior source said. The bodies of four people were found in two different districts of the capital, a Ministry of Interior source said. In Karbala, gunmen gunned down a policeman on Wednesday. In Karbala also, the police found the body of an old man who had been shot in the head in Karbala. And Baghdad, Dateline Baghdad, Associated Press reports the shooting death of a pregnant Iraqi, apparently by U.S. troops, as she was being rushed to a hospital through an intense spotlight Wednesday on the troubling issue of Iraqi civilian deaths. Iraqi police and witnesses said the troops gunned down Nabiha Nisayef Jassim, a 35-year-old pregnant woman, and her cousin Salia Mohammed Hassan, 57, in their car. The U.S. military said the car entered a clearly marked prohibited area but failed to stop despite repeated signals. Shots were fired to disable the vehicle, it said. Jassim's brother, however, Khalid Nassif Yassim, said he was speeding to get to a maternity hospital in Samarra when shots were fired at his car. He said the shooting happened on a side road that the U.S. military closed 2 weeks ago. News of the closure, he said, was slow to reach the area outside Samarra where his family lives. Cousins' bodies were taken to Samarra General Hospital, where relatives said doctors failed to save the pregnant woman's baby. U.S. military said its forces later received reports from Iraqi police that two women had died from gunshot wounds, and one of the females may have been pregnant. The incident is under investigation. Nabi Nassif Jassim is survived by a husband, 36-year-old Hussein Taufik, and two children, Hashimaya, 2, and Ali, 1. Taufik was at the hospital when his wife was shot. He said, "May God take revenge on the Americans and those who brought them here." At a time when U.S. Marines Notes the Associated Press are investigating an alleged massacre of Iraqi men, women, and children in Haditha last fall. The military says it strives to avoid civilian casualties. The military said the loss of life is regrettable. In the meantime, the right wing has been engaged in an effort, this from Think Progress, to downplay the deteriorating security situation in Iraq. Newsmax, the latest to jump on this thing, suggesting that the violent death rates in Washington, D.C. are higher than those in Iraq. Now, I'm not kidding. The right-wing website Newsmax, they ran this piece. It says, despite media coverage purporting to show that escalating violence in Iraq has the country spiraling out of control, civilian death statistics compiled by Representative Stephen King, Republican of Iowa, indicate that Iraq actually has a lower civilian violent death rate than Washington, D.C. Right. They note, by the way, that this so-called report has appeared in the New York Sun and on the Rush Limbaugh show. The report, however, is false and deceptive. The report says, King said he came up with an annualized Iraqi civilian death rate of 27.51 per 100,000. Okay. King uses 2002 data for Washington, D.C., finding a violent casualty rate of 45.9 deaths for 100,000 people. That number is badly outdated. In 2004, it was 35.8 deaths per 100,000. 198 homicides total in D.C. for the entire year. According to the Pentagon's own data released today, they have been 94 violent casualties. Now, keep in mind, 198 for an entire year of 2004 in Washington, D.C. There have been 94 violent casualties per day in Iraq between February and May of 2006. That translates into 34,310 deaths per year in Iraq. For an Iraqi population of 26.77 million plus another 150,000 coalition forces, the violent casualty rate in Iraq is 128 deaths per 100,000. Lastly, the King Report is trying to conflate the data from one urban area in the U.S. with the entire country of Iraq. As Opinion Journal writes, the comparison with U.S. cities poses a problem of scale. Just as some municipalities here have high concentrations of crime, Baghdad and some other Iraqi cities have high concentrations of military, guerrilla, and terrorist activity. A comparison of Baghdad with Los Angeles or a similarly sprawling U.S. city would be more enlightening. Sadly, enlightenment is not what the right-wingers are trying to bring about. In fact, I would say I'm beginning to wonder if Limbaugh has just, like, gone off the edge. I mean, he's said over the years some strange things. You know, global warming, for example.
I think the modern environmental movement is simply the latest refuge for communists and socialists who are opposed to capitalism.
Yeah, okay. Well, you could say that's just, you know, being a crackpot, right? Or women's rights, the women's rights movement, Limbaugh.
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
Unattractive women should not have access to the mainstream of society, apparently, in Limbaugh's world. But now he's completely lost it. I mean, he has completely lost it. You wonder, you know, is he back on the OxyContin, or does he need to be, you know, one of the, or is he on some new kind of med? I don't know, but he's got to be hallucinating. Just catch this.
It's Oceanside, California. Jack, glad you called, sir. Great to have you on the EIB network.
Rush, John Kerry said about Vietnam, no one wants to be the last one to die for a mistake. Incidents like Haditha will make it impossible to achieve the goal of creating a democracy in Iraq that is friendly to the United States. Rush, are you now willing to admit Iraq is a disaster, a mistake, and it's time to bring our troops home? Unless you and your arrogance...
Now, up to that point, this guy is basically saying, you know, come on, Rush, Iraq is melting down. Are you going to admit to it? And you would expect some kind of a response that has something to do with the question, perhaps?
Are willing to send more of our young men and women.
Jack, tell us all your real name, will you?
Tell us your real name? Tell us your... Yeah, right. I think my real name is Jack. Last I looked, it's a...
And tell us where you really live.
Wherever I said I was calling from.
Tell us who you really are, Jack. Give us your real name. And also, you might want to tell us when you're going to be in Las Vegas. That's coming up soon, isn't it?
What's that? I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yes, you do. Tell us your real name, Jack. You're an imposter. You make anagrams and reading prepared speeches like this.
Now, the guy did sound like he was, you know, reading from a note card or something when he called in. But, I mean, that happens on this program from time to time. People write things down so they don't forget. You know, it's fresh in their mind. You know, we don't like people to read on the air, particularly quoting somebody else. But, you know, it happens. But Limbaugh, I mean, this sounds like clinical. But you're going to Las Vegas soon, aren't you? What? I mean, what is this? The space aliens are coming.
Gibberish that you just shared with us, making demands of me. So tell us who you really are, Jack. I want to know your real name.
Well, you know, you're just displaying to your audience that you can't answer my question.
No, what I'm displaying to my audience is that I don't put up with liars and frauds on this program. You don't have to lie to get on this program, and when you do, your time is cut short. Why should I give credence? Why should I respond and descend to your level to answer your silly, nonsensical, biased, agenda-oriented questions? I'm not going to waste my time. Just tell us who you are, Jack, and tell us where you really live.
Well, you know, I think you've lost your marbles.
There you go. And Rush responds, he's got all three of his marbles. Say what?
No, Jack. I'm full possession of all three.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Marbles.
You need to address what I just said.
No, I don't have to address a damn thing that you just said,
Jack.
Well,
the point is, you're willing to send more men and women.
No, Jack. Jack, you are a fraud, and I.
Anyhow, he goes off on this. He just a general rant. Somebody needs to run some OxyContin out to New York City fast. This is getting scary. Next, Berlusconi, feeling the heat in Italy, and we'll be taking your calls. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Every breath you take, every call you make, every bite of steak, for our nation's sake, we'll be watching you. Every single day, we'll check your dossier. We see where you pray, what you buy, what you pay, because we're watching you.
Ah, yes, Mr. Gonzalez and Death Squad John. Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. Limbaugh finally loses it all together with this caller. I hadn't heard the tail end of this. Here it is.
You just
well, the
said,
point
Jack,
is, you're willing
you,
to send more
no, Jack,
men and women.
Jack,
to
you are a fraud, and I don't address anything. I will address things on my own time in my own way, but I am not going to allow some lowlife to put me on the defensive and make me assume the position of defending a position that I don't even know is true based on just your simple assertion. I've given you three chances now to come clean, to be honest, and tell us who you really are. I happen to know who you are, Jack, and if you try this one more time, I'm going to blow your cover so that everybody else knows who you are and just ruin your little scam that you got going out there. We'll be back in just a second.
I wonder if all across America people are calling right now to say, Jack here, David in Augusta, Maine. You know something about this, David?
Yes, I do. This has to do with callingallwingnuts.com. And basically what this guy has been doing is he's been calling conservative radio nonstop every day a different person and hitting them up with basically truthful questions and hopefully to touch an emotional issue and to get something out there, a point across, other than just talking points.
Uh-huh.
And what he's been doing to Rush Limbaugh, basically, just to sum it up real fast, is he's been constantly on him and he's been found a way to get through to the phone lines.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, Rush is snapping because he doesn't know how to stop this guy.
Interesting. Interesting. He knows how to get past this call. You know what's so weird is that these right-wing guys go to such efforts to filter out contrasting points of view. And I try so hard to get conservatives to call this program because I like it when people disagree with me. I think it's important to have both points of view out there, and they won't call.
Tom, there's one more interesting thing about this guy. He's a four-year Marine veteran.
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually trying to point out the things that was going on in the military at the time when he was there, and that really touches, that really rubs the conservatives the wrong way. And when I say he hits all the conservative shows, he doesn't just hit the mainstream shows, he hits the local shows too. You know, he would be a good segment to add for your show because he's constantly on it every day, updating his website, callingallwingnuts.com.
That's great. I'll check it out. And if you know how to get in touch with him, feel free to drop
it. Just go to that website. And you can. He even has a blog on dailycoast.com. It's uh-huh. picking up steam right now.
Oh, and thus the you're going to Las Vegas.
I guess so.
I think that's the annual Coast Convention.
Where it's from, yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
I just wanted to explain that to you.
Well,
Tom.
David, thank you for enlightening me.
No problem.
I thought he had gone over the edge. It doesn't mean Limbaugh hasn't gone over the edge, but at least we understand a little better. David, thank you very much. And David Poole, you wrote down the website. We got it. Okay, we're going to track this thing down. Steve in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing? About the Jared Bernstein segment, I think it's really important to also note that concurrent with his pointing out concurrent with this macroeconomic propaganda campaign which we have lived under for the last 30 years, the voodoo economics and privatization macroeconomic propaganda, there has been a microeconomic propaganda assault on the working and lower middle classes of this country, and a huge part of it, the media has used the pop psychology community, the Dr. Laura Schlesinger's, the Dr. Phil's, this whole personal responsibility thing, wherein you really have it. I see it in my day-to-day life talking to people from those kind of economic levels, where you really have this self-esteem problem with the working class who really think that they're inadequate. They can't put the numbers together. Like a family of four, a young couple with two little kids, has a net income of $2,500, $3,000 a month, and they can't put the numbers together. Gee, why? I must be inadequate. I can't make $1,000 a month for health insurance for my family of four. I can't make $1,800 a month for rent or a mortgage, or $1,500 a month for my family of four. I can't, depending on the age of the kids, I can't supply them with the crap that is coming out of the television, the Power Rangers and the this and the that. I can't, they don't add up the numbers and ever come to the conclusion that, hey, they're $8 an hour each with no benefits wage is not enough.
What's interesting,
and
Steve?
And in a time of record profits for the corporate level,
sure,
there is an unpaid wage here.
During the Victorian era, particularly after Darwin's writing, I mean, he was basically, his theory of biology was supporting a theory of economics, and there was a widespread belief that the poor classes were genetically inferior, and in fact, it was believed by the poor themselves in Victorian England. During the potato famine in the 1848, as I recall, in Ireland, Ireland was actually exporting enough wheat to England to feed the million people who died of starvation in Ireland when the potato famine happened.
I've heard you say that.
But there was not just the military oppression of these folks. There was also the psychological oppression of them. They actually believed that the British were somehow superior to them and that they should be doing what they were told. After all, this is the king's will and all that kind of thing. And you're spot on when you say that Dr. Laura, Dr. Phil, this whole pop psych industry is feeding this thing. They blame the victim. It's just an absolute blame-the-victim mentality. It's very, very bad for America. After the break, the theft of the American vote, to Dave Berman of the Gov World blog. And that, your calls and more, right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least clean elections, the Tom Hartman radio program. Checking out callingallwingnuts.com. It just turns out that Jack was actually Jack. Thanks to the caller from Maine for turning us onto this website. This is fascinating. But apparently the right-wing talk shows, I think what's happening is America is starting to talk back. America is just starting to see, there is such a momentum, such a number of Americans who are saying, you've got this kind of classic bit from O'Reilly, the same kind of nutty, over-the-top stuff.
Orlando, Florida, Mike, go.
Hey, Bill, I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I like to listen to you during the day. I think Keith Olbermann's show.
There you go. Mike is, he's a gone guy. You know, we have your phone numbers, by the way. So if you're listening, Mike, we have your phone number. And we're going to turn it over to Fox Security. And you'll be getting a little visit.
Maybe Mike is from the mothership.
No, maybe Mike's going to get in big trouble. Because we're not going to play around. When you call us, ladies and gentlemen, just so you know, we do have your phone number. And if you say anything untoward, obscene, or anything like that, Fox Security, then we'll contact your local authorities, and you will be held accountable. Fair?
That's fair.
So just all you guys who do this kind of a thing, you know, I know some shock jocks, whatever, you will be held accountable. Believe it. We'll be right back.
Yeah, believe it. Anyhow, we'll come back to that in a few minutes. This is fascinating. But right now, Dave Berman is with us. His website, wedonotconsent.blogspot.com. Coincidentally, the title of his book, We Do Not Consent, which you can actually download on the website, wedonotconsent.blogspot.com. Dave Berman, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Dave, you're a reasonable chronicler of the state of elections and voting machines and voting theft in this country. What's going on? Where are we right now?
Well, I typically don't talk about it in terms of theft, and I don't even really do the chronicling that places like Brad Blog and Vote Trust USA do a better job with. What I'm more interested in doing is organizing the response from the people with the message, we do not consent.
Okay, so how is the message organized?
Well, for starters, we have a resolution called the Voter Confidence Resolution, which was developed through my previous blog, which was called GovWorld, in which all of the essays in my book originally appeared there. And the resolution, the Voter Confidence Resolution, was adopted by the City Council of Arcata, California last July, and it's currently pending before the City Council of Palo Alto, California. And we're looking to see citizen groups around the country organize themselves for the purpose of pursuing local adoption of this resolution, which says that election conditions guarantee inconclusive results. We're never going to have unanimous acceptance of the results when they're unverifiable elections. And it says that under these conditions, the consent of the governed is not even being sought. And so we have to shatter the assumption that consent actually exists.
And the consent of the governed is the basis of American democracy in the American Republic.
You know it. Yeah, I mean, from the Declaration of Independence, it is the source from which government's just power is derived. And so we do not have to grant that, and we should not allow it to be taken for granted. So it's time to withdraw the consent of the governed.
That's great. We do not consent. The book, the election reform is not an end goal, you say, but it's a tactic toward peaceful revolution?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why I refer you to Brad Blog and Vote Trust USA and, you know, all the many, many great organizations that have come up throughout the country over the past few years. We do need to do the actual work of identifying appropriate reforms and pursuing them. But the thing is, even if we are successful at getting our elections to be verifiable, where are we? I mean, we have a government that is lawless. We have a government that has taken away completely our right to privacy, our right to free speech. You want to protest, they'll put you in a free speech zone. We've lost our presumption of innocence. You can just be jailed for nothing. So even if we are to fix our elections, I'm afraid that that's not the be-all, end-all.
No, we have a lot of work to do. We have it's amazing the amount of damage that Bush has done in 5 years.
No doubt.
I mean, it's just mind-boggling. So, Dave Berman, if local groups, if people listening to this program right now want to try to get a We Do Not Consent type of resolution passed by their city council, their county board, their state legislature, whatever it may be, how do they do that?
Well, the first thing would be to grab the copy off of the We Do Not Consent.blogspot website. What we have maintained since the beginning is that the resolution that we got accepted here in Humboldt County by the Arcata City Council should be regarded as a template. There's certain key elements that should be preserved from one community to another, but there's a big section of it that is basically an election reform platform. And so here's you know, where the discussion and debate is really open, where every community needs to kind of take a shot at developing their own local standards for what is going to create a basis for confidence. Right now, we're being asked through unverifiable elections to have blind trust in the results. And instead, we need to create a basis for confidence.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So people should download the resolution from wedonotconsent.blogspot.com and then...
Well, then begin organizing and begin lobbying your city council or your county supervisors. I mean, I think it really needs to be on the local level.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Okay, Dave Berman, his book, We Do Not Consent, the website, wedonotconsent.blogspot.com. Dave, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's a great start. It's a great start of getting out there and saying, nope, sorry, we're not going to play this game. And I think we need to do more of that. Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
First of all, I was wondering if you personally think that the Democrats who authorized the war should be forgiven, let alone reelected.
Gee, that's a good question. I've never thought of it in the terms of forgiven or not forgiven.
Well, at least, I mean, in terms of being elected, that's the real question, you know?
Yeah. I think a lot should be determined by their behavior since they voted for the war. For example, you have people who voted for the war like John Edwards who have come out and said, that was a terrible mistake. I was lied to. I was misled. I believed the lies of this administration, and I voted that way. And if I knew now what I knew then what I know now, I would not have done it. And I'm sorry I did it. Okay, John Edwards, I would vote for again. In fact, I'd vote for him for president, frankly. On the other hand, you've got Hillary Clinton saying, you know, it's a fine and noble cause, and we need to stay the course, and George Bush is right, and all that kind of thing. You know, I'm not quoting her verbatim, but you know, words to that effect. And I would not vote for her.
Well, we all know you're an authority.
So I think that there's a spectrum there, you know.
Under the Constitution, you're an authority, among other things. And I'm just wondering if you personally think that the vote was, the way it was written, was unconstitutional. I think it was.
Well, first of all, I'm not an authority about the Constitution. I'm a talk show host and an author. I'm not an attorney, and I didn't go to law school. So, but
compared to most people, you're
said, I'm a fairly well-educated layman, Jay. And that said, yes, I believe that the resolution that was passed by both houses of Congress, that Robert Byrd so strongly objected to, that the basis of his objection was legitimate. When Robert Byrd said, basically, if you're going to declare a war, you have to declare a war. And if you're not going to declare a war, you have to not declare a war. And there's no kind of wishy-washy in-between where we give all this power to the president and then stand back and say, well, you know, okay, we're not responsible for this now. It's all in his ballpark. And he can do whatever he wants forever. You have to narrowly circumscribe it. So, no, I have very serious doubts about the constitutionality or the legality, for that matter, of the resolution that was passed that Bush is using as the basis for not only only the war in Iraq, and now to say he says he doesn't even need another resolution to go after Syria or to go after Iran or to go after any other country. And for that matter, he's using that as the basis for wiretapping us and for, you know, getting our phone numbers and the numbers that we've called the whole NSA sweep thing for holding American citizens like Jose Padilla without access to an attorney, without trial. I mean, all these things that are just absolutely wrong. And he claims that they all came out of that resolution. A, I don't think they did, but B, whether they did or not, I don't think the resolution is constitutional.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with your point about Robert Byrd, but I'm shocked that if you feel that way, you're so kind and forgiving to John Edwards and everyone else like him, even if he has admitted after the fact. Real accountability with him saying, after the fact, I'm not going to run again. This was a horrible mistake. I should be in jail. And sure as hell, I apologize to unbelief, and I did something that was against the law. If they get a second chance, is one of those things where you shouldn't have a second chance, considering the ramifications.
Well, you know, again, Jay, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and I really think that those folks who are willing to say it was wrong what I did, and, you know, that we should take that seriously, and those folks who are still advocating for this war, I can't support. Jay, thanks for the call. You make your point well, and you're eloquent about it. After the break, taking our country back with Russ Warner. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back. We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're drowning deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires. And you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today.
And we're taking our country back, my friends, one district at a time. Some months ago, we asked Congressman Bernie Sanders one of our callers called up and said, what can I do? I've got $100. I want to contribute it to somebody. What should I do? Should I send it to the Democratic National Committee? What do I do? And Bernie said, find people running for Congress who share your values, who share your perspective, and support them individually. And so what we've been doing on this program every couple of days, actually, now at least once a week, 2-3 times a week sometimes, trying to get people on who are good progressives out there fighting the good fight and running for public office. Today we have Russ Warner with us. He's running for Congress in California's 26th Congressional District. The website Warner for Congress. Russ Warner, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Great to have you here. I just tried to hit your website, Russ, Warner, W-A-R-N-E-R-F-O-R, congress.com, and it bounced back as not there.
It's there. You can also just type in Russ Warner, R-U-S-S-W-A-R-N-E-R, and there's quite a few things that should pop up there, about 7 or 8.
If I Google it, okay. Just trying to make sure that I've got the information here. Now you're going to be running. First of all, you have a primary that's coming up in the next week or so. And if you make it through the primary, you'll be taking on David Dreyer. Am I accurately characterizing things?
Yes, that's true. Right now, I looks as if I'm the front runner, but I believe that I'm going to run as far as I can and wait till that last vote gets counted, because I know I'm going to be out knocking on doors and phone banking and being in street fairs and farmers markets. And I really think that's what it's all about, making sure that you can get every vote you can get.
And I see now I'm Warner, F-O-R, congress.com is working for me. And General Wesley Clark has endorsed you. That's pretty good. That's a big deal.
Yes, it is. Matter of fact, we were also endorsed by the Inland Valley Daily Bulletin, which is the largest conservative newspaper out here. And they have not endorsed a Democrat running for Congress in this district in many years.
Now, why would that happen? Why would they do that?
I have no idea. I went in for the interview, and it went very well. And we have no idea what they're going to print. And when it came out yesterday, we were absolutely ecstatic.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just go through some of the issues here, Russ Warner. With regard to the economy, what do you suggest we should be doing?
Well, with the economy itself?
Yeah.
Well, the economy itself right now, everyone seems to think it's going pretty well. I know that the national debt, the ceiling is going to be raised to $11.5 trillion. But I believe the economy itself, it's great for small business. And that's something that this administration hasn't been working with, is small family businesses and small businesses. And for some reason, they keep cutting the funding on the loan programs for small businesses. And yet, if you look at everything out there, this country is based on small family businesses that start from their garage and work up and eventually become huge corporations, and that's all part of the American dream. And I just don't understand why they're not doing more for small family businesses.
Well, because they're doing things for large multinational businesses.
That's absolutely right.
I mean, it's really
right.
That simple.
Yeah, absolutely. Matter of fact, I saw Howard Dean a couple months ago, and he said this country should be run like a business. And all the way home, that just bugged the heck out of me. And by the time I got home, I realized that Enron used to be a business. Walmart is a business. And no, this country should be run like a small family business, because if it were, we'd teach our children to respect their seniors and others. We'd want the best education, health care that we can afford.
Yeah.
We'd teach our children about their heritage and who they are and where they're from, and to be proud of that. And we teach them about fiscal responsibility. Because
I would suggest we need to run our government like a government. Russ, we have about a half a minute left. Healthcare, you say it's time to stop bowing to the medical and pharmaceutical industries? Why not extend Medicare to everybody in the United States?
Well, I would like to see some sort of universal health care. I believe the American people deserve it. We're the last industrialized nation on the face of the earth that doesn't have it, South Africa being the last one. Our health care in this country is not as good as it could be, and I believe it would give us the right to negotiate directly with the large pharmaceutical companies and the large insurance medical companies. And we'd be able to lower the rates and probably save millions, if not billions, of dollars. I know right here in California alone, we estimate we'd save over $3 to $5 billion a year.
Yeah, well said. Russ Warner, the website Warner for Congress, forcongress.com. He's going to be running against David Dreyer in the fall. That guy is very toxic.
Yes, matter of fact, he is head of the House Rules Committee, and he's done everything to advance the Bush administration's agenda. And we got to get him out of there so we can take back the country.
Well said. Russ Warner. Warner for Congress. Russ, thanks for being with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best. I'm the decider.
I figured that it couldn't be too difficult.
Do I hear the voices?
To be president of the USA.
I read the front page, and I know the speculation.
I saw my dad do it. How hard could it be? Then the office finally came to me. Now I'm in control. I'm the decider.
But I'm the decider.
That's my role. Not a doubt in my mind.
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
I'm always right. I'm the decider. I don't do all-nighters. That's not me.
That's how I work. I'm the decider.
People seem to think that it takes brains and stuff.
I don't know why you say that.
But hey, nuclear physics, this is not.
See, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case.
Anyone could do it. Harry Dick or Tom. The hardest part's deciding where to bomb.
I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq.
But that's my job.
He's the decider. Welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour, or 25 before, as you half full or half empty, or half past or half before. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. And now, Berlusconi alert! Oh my goodness, it's been so long since we've had one. And we've missed him, Silvio Berlusconi. You will recall good old Silvio. Who actually started out his career as a lounge singer. This isn't him. He's not that good. And then he was a small businessman, and then he bought a radio station, and then he bought a TV station, and then he bought another radio station, and then he bought another TV station, and then he bought a newspaper, and then he bought another radio station, then he bought a radio network, then he bought a TV network, then he bought another radio network, then he bought another TV network, then he bought the last radio network, he bought the last TV network, and then he bought some more newspapers until he controlled the media that 90% of Italians got their news from, the remaining 10% being the state-run media, the Italian equivalent of public radio and public television. And then he ran for prime minister. And guess what? He won. Well, the first time, that was 5 years ago. Last time around, though, the people kind of figured out that having an eccentric billionaire who just happens to own all the media in the country might seem kind of cool for getting lots of good coverage, but it's not good for governing a nation. So he got bounced out. Bounced out on his butt. Romano Prodi beat him in the last election, and now he may be prosecuted, because as long as he was prime minister, he couldn't be prosecuted. He had sovereign immunity, and there were laws actually passed to prevent him from being prosecuted. But hear this from The Guardian. Former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is being targeted by anti-corruption prosecutors in Spain just 2 weeks after losing his right to immunity from prosecution. 8 of his business partners and employee in Teleco will go on trial in Madrid on Monday. They face prison sentences of up to 14 years for alleged tax and document fraud. It's all about Silvio. The case opens as Mr. Berlusconi also looks set to sail once more into stormy legal waters in Italy. A Milan court is due to open a committal hearing on Monday into which he's accused of bribing David Mills, the estranged husband of the Secretary of the Culture, Teresa Jowell. Mr. Berlusconi's fate in the Italian courts in the hands of his political opponent, Romano Prodi. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. And a fine one it is. An absolutely fine one it is. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great. What's up?
I'd just like to remind the listeners that George W. Bush's buddy, Berlusconi in Italy, considered himself to be a new Mussolini. And, you know, considering that...
And Bush bragged about it.
Yeah, exactly. And considering that George Bush's family money, a large part of it came directly from, guess where, Nazi Germany. You know, his grandfather, Prescott, was Hitler's banker.
Well, you don't have to go back that far. You know, the phony memo about the uranium in Niger,
it was
created at Berlusconi's order by the Italian Secret Service.
You know, it's like these guys get behind the scene, Blair, Bush, Berlusconi, they cook up this phony war where they lie about weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the fact is, George W. Bush thinks he's the decider. Bush is not the decider. Bush is the liar.
Yeah.
And
well, he's both, actually, tragically, right now.
Hear the voices.
Whoops. Okay, we got it. Yeah, continue. Sorry, Jake. Every now and then he just gets out of...
So I hear the voices.
Oh, geez.
And I read the front
again.
Page.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Continue.
Well, I guess that's where Bush gets the political advice from, the voices in his head.
Yep.
Everybody should read that book, Bush on the Couch, by the way.
By John Frank, yeah.
Exactly. And the whole point here is this war in Iraq is a total failure. It was based on lies. You know, Rush Limbaugh wants to call his liberal callers, you know, liars and frauds. Well, you know, the Republican Party is based on lies and fraud at this point, electoral fraud. Bush wasn't even elected in the first place.
Yep.
And the fact is this war has to be brought to an end, and the Democratic Party needs to put this front and center. We need to do what John Murtha says, get these troops out of there, because this war is a disaster.
I agree. I agree, and it is melting down not just Iraq, and it's melting down the American troops. It is harming America, and the billions, the hundreds of billions of dollars that are being spent on this could be put to such good use here in the United States. Jake, thank you for the call and for your comments. Appreciate it. Mike in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today?
Good.
You know, I just wanted to bring to your attention, if you haven't already run across it, the new book by David James Duncan called God Laughs and Plays.
I am completely unfamiliar with that.
Oh, well, put it at the top of your to-do list as of this very moment.
Okay.
It really addresses all of this this incredible takeover of, or the attempted takeover of Christianity by whoever these folks are. They're not right-wing, and they're certainly not conservative.
They are fearful. I think what you have are very fearful, by and large, men who are trying to assuage their fear by having absolute control over their environment and everything around them and it. And, of course, theocracy, religion, is one of the historic ways to control people, and there it is.
That's right, yeah, and it really has, you're precisely right, it has a lot to do with this built-in misogynistic attitude of us, you know, and... Yeah. And it's just a really, it's an important piece of work, and I really highly recommend it to you.
Okay, once again, God Laughs and Plays by whom?
David James Duncan.
He wrote
Brothers Cain and River Wye.
Okay, great.
And really, and he addressed directly that awkward thing about fiction and nonfiction, and if you look them up, they're actually mostly the same definition. And,
yeah.
And, you know, the writers of nonfiction are, in fact, writers, after all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Everything gets filtered through a human at some point.
That's right, and it's filtered through the writer, and it's filtered through the reader. At the same time, the distinction is almost non-secondary. It almost doesn't even matter, and these guys know that.
Yep.
And so they push the archetype, and they push the fear, and the reason that the Dixie Chicks are catching all this stuff is that they're not making nice, you know?
Yeah, well, I think the Dixie Chicks are catching on. I mean, number one in the country charts yesterday.
Yeah, I know.
It's incredible, and I think it's, I don't think it's crossover. I don't think it's, rock and rollers deciding that they love the Dixie Chicks. I think it's that it's like, you know, you go to MerleHaggard.com, Haggard, the guy who did the song Okie from Muskogee, I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, and right there is, in fact, maybe I can bring it up. Yeah, I got it right here. And you go to his site, and right there on his site is him doing a music video of his song where he's saying basically no to the Bushies.
And
I'm telling you, when you've lost Merle Haggard, the guy who said, we don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee, we don't grow our hair long like them hippies, and you got him singing a song trashing Bush, then George W. Bush is in serious, serious trouble.
Right, and the power of the archetype, though, is what the framers used. That's what Rove knows how to use best.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, here's a little bit of Merle Haggard, just for you.
Check out
Mike,
this.
Thanks a lot for the call. As I said, when you've lost Merle, you've lost it all.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
There you go. And it's just, I just don't think the Dixie Chicks going to the top of the charts is weird. I mean, when Merle Haggard is singing these songs, at the very end it goes dedicated to Johnny Cash. It's like the middle America. I have some familiarity with this. I started out in radio in 1968 as a country and western DJ, even though I was I hated country and western music when I was 17 years old. I thought, but it was a job. And, within a year I was a junkie of it. And then, I went from that to doing rock and roll and doing overnight progressive rock, and then did news for 7 years. But so now you know my radio history. But in any case, when country music fans turn against the president, the most conservative part of America is gone, and they're not going to come back. Bush thinks these guys are going to come back. They're not going to come back. I'm telling you, it is just over for Bush. And Merle Haggard just laying it out just so well. Here, I think we got one little piece of it. No, he's just going around the music. So anyhow, this is the time, as they say. This is the appointed time that we have to be doing something about it. We have to be getting politically active. We have to be waking people up and spreading the good word. And by the way, you can check that out at MerleHaggard.com. Real simple. We'll be back with the rest of your calls here right after this, 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. You're right.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Where was the passion you needed the most? Oh, you and I. You kick up the leaves and the magic is lost. 'Cause you had a bad day, you take it one down.
Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason and passion go together, like Republican presidents and gay hookers. Isn't it amazing how the hosts on the mainstream media, CBS News, for example, Harry Smith, how they parrot the extremist right-wing talking points, like that Al Gore is concerned about the environment because he wants to destroy capitalism. Right? I mean, isn't it amazing? Here's Harry Smith this morning talking to Al Gore, and Al Gore giving it right back.
If I look at more elements, the more conservative elements of the press, I would say there is a debate going on because, you know, they say that you're just trying to create this kind of boogeyman to help slow down the economy and everything else. How do you respond to that?
Well, I guess in some quarters there's still a debate over whether the moon landing was staged in a movie lot in Arizona, or whether the Earth is flat instead of round. And there may be some media reports that are constructed in a way that says on the one hand, on the other hand. But really and truly, global warming is in that category. There is no more scientific debate among serious people who've looked at the evidence.
And you know, thank God Al Gore is you know, speaking up. I almost said finally. It's not just finally, but he's speaking up on this stuff and just, you know, coming right out and saying it right out loud. Jack Cafferty yesterday, again, the old right-wing curmudgeon, Jack Cafferty, on the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer.
President Bush comparing himself to President Truman and the war against Islamic radicals to the Cold War. Speaking at West Point the other day, the president said, in both cases, we have been fighting, quote, followers of a murderous ideology that despises freedom, crushes all dissent, has territorial ambitions, and pursues totalitarian aims. In comparing himself to President Truman, Mr. Bush pointed to the ways both have responded to threats to the United States. There is one difference worth noting, however. That would be that President Truman didn't invade anybody the way President Bush invaded Iraq. It's also worth noting that Truman was controversial at the end of his time in office, but is now viewed by many as one of America's great presidents.
And nobody is going to view George Bush that way. Just, you know, it's just a given. BJ in University Place, Washington. Hey, BJ, what's up?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Good.
Speaking about the war resolution, the one thing I haven't heard from anyone is they need to pass concurrent resolutions, one, rescinding the power of the president and giving him the right to make war, and then another one, specifically stating things like you're not allowed to tap people's phones unless you go through the FISA court.
Well, they already have that law. That law exists on the books.
But they need to take this, because instead of fighting this out and having a committee here and hearing time and time again, this is what we did say and this is what we wanted you to do, take it away. Take your
power
away.
Well, here's the problem, BJ. As long as Republicans control the House and the Senate, this very rational process that you're suggesting is not going to happen, because they're going to continue to allow this guy to break the law and to violate the will of the people of the United States, of the world for that matter, and pursue his own right-wing extremist agenda and try to cover their own butts. They're going to continue to do that, and that's why it's so important.
I agree. And that's
every
why
race across America, we do everything we can to get Democrats elected, period.
And that's why I'm trying to do everything I can, and I'm going to my Democratic meetings, because I think as soon as November hits, but I would like to hear congressmen and Democratic candidates speaking out and saying, this is what we'd like to do.
And we're featuring them on this show, and I don't even agree with all of the positions of all of them, but, you know, if I get somebody who's 70-80% decent, I mean, it's better than, you know, and they're running against a Republican incumbent, you know, I'll send them $25 and I'll do whatever I can to help them out and put them on the air. And
I agree.
BJ, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. By the way, on this day in history, in 1812, President James Madison, speaking of declarations of war, President James Madison on June 1st, 1812, went before Congress and said, I would like a declaration of war against England, against the United Kingdom. It took Congress a couple of weeks to put it together. It wasn't until, as I recall, June 17th, 18th, something like that he actually got a war resolution. But that was the beginning of the War of 1812. And the War of 1812 didn't go so well all the time. There, by 1814, the British actually came up the Chesapeake Bay and took Washington, D.C., burned down the White House. Dolly Madison grabbing paintings off the wall and taking valuables out of the White House. James Madison fleeing to Virginia so that the President of the United States wouldn't be captured by the British. They burned down the White House, then they went down the street and burned down the Treasury building. They thought they were winning. And even then, even with a foreign army occupying the United States and having burned the White House, the president did not say, we need to suspend Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. We need to suspend First Amendment rights of free speech. We need to put up free speech zones around me wherever I go so that nobody can contradict me. I'm telling you, James Madison fought that war, 1812 to 1814. It really resolved in 1815. John Quincy Adams, John Adams' son, wrapped it up, as it were. And when Bush does this stuff, he is spitting in the face of these former presidents. He is just absolutely spitting in their faces. And it is so wrong. And we need to remember the history of this country. We actually had a war in 1812, in 13, in 1814. We actually had a war and with the British. And, you know, a lot of the conflict took place on our borders over Lake Erie. I mean, the British coming through Canada, up at the northern borders. Yeah, but the British forces, and by the way, what started the war was impressment by and large. The fact that our commercial ships sailing across the Atlantic for commerce with England kept getting attacked by the British, and they would literally steal these commercial sailors and force them to become slaves in the British Navy. And finally, James Madison said, enough is enough. You can't do this anymore. So, you know, there was a basis for this thing. But even with the White House on fire, the president didn't say, oh, no, we're going to be able to read your mail. Even then. Coming up tomorrow, conservative David Tebow. We're going to be talking about the new South Dakota law on abortion. Congressman Bernie Sanders, of course, Brunch with Bernie. That and more on your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group up by and for We the People. Remember, democracy begins with you, my friends. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.